and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, March 21st, 2021, on the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service. I am your reader, Sharon Faldudo. I am reading from my kitchen table in Coralville, Iowa, and this is the Cedar Rapids Gazette. On the front page of today's Gazette, Magnet for Danger, House Alarms Neighbors. CR cracks down after bullets and bomb target house, by Trish Mahaffey of the Gazette. What was once a quiet neighborhood, where a mother didn't have to worry about her kids riding their bikes to nearby Beaver Park, has transformed into one where neighbors say they have been subject to bullets from drive-by shooting striking their homes, stolen cars being abandoned on the street, and noise at all hours of the night. One neighbor called it a living hell. Another said he and his family lived in the basement for 6 months out of fear of stray bullets. City officials and neighbors point to one address as a magnet for the neighborhood mayhem, a rental house at 2307 Beaver Avenue Southeast. "Believe me, I share the neighbors' frustration and understand their fear," said Cedar Rapids Police Chief Wayne German. "This is how one house, how an incident of shots fired can impact a neighborhood and have a negative impact on everyone. They shouldn't have to face it. They deserve and are entitled to live in a quiet neighborhood." Last year, from January 1st through October 15th, there were 25 disturbance calls, 13 weapon calls, 2 thefts, 1 domestic incident, and 7 suspicious persons reports in connection with 2307 Beaver Avenue Southeast, said Cedar Rapids Police Lieutenant Corey McGarvey. Officers also have made 8 arrests since 2018 of tenants who lived there, including charges of assaults, outstanding warrants, carrying weapons, drugs, harassment, possession of firearms as a felon, and robbery, according to police reports. Many of those arrested were juveniles. McGarvey said the house first came to his attention in January 2020, after a drive-by shooting there on December 30, 2019. The department put extra patrols in the area and made 531 proactive visits to the neighborhood from January 1st through October 15, 2020. When officers had paperwork to catch up on, they would park nearby and monitor the neighborhood. As the incidents escalated from trespassing and disturbances to shots fired and even a pipe bomb exploding, police started working with the city's Safe CR, which addresses nuisance and building code violations. Last year, the city deemed the house a nuisance property, along with 3 other properties also owned by Charles A. Davison, 58, of Cedar Rapids, who has these and other properties listed under Property Holders LTD. The city later suspended property holders from renting out the 4 properties, a decision Davison is appealing. Peter Riley, Davison's Cedar Rapids attorney, said most of the trouble at 2307 Beaver Avenue Southeast stemmed from a young man who no longer lives there. At one of the other properties, also declared a nuisance, 619 15th Street Southeast, most of the issues were because of a tenant who property holders tried to evict but was denied by the courts, Riley said. Amanda Greider, Public Safety Program Manager with Safe CR, said there have been chronic enforcement issues on the 4 properties, 2307 Beaver Avenue Southeast, 619 15th Street Southeast, 1557 6th Avenue Southeast, and 1025 20th Street Southeast. Greider told the city's Housing Board of Appeals the Beaver Avenue house became a nuisance in July 2020, and Davison didn't appeal nor submit a nuisance abatement plan to correct the violations, and the calls to police continued. When a property is deemed a nuisance, it is based on the type of police calls for that address in accordance with nuisance and housing codes. In September, a request was made to revoke or suspend his rental unit registration. The occupant at that time, Michael Anthony White Sr., 52, also an employee of Property Holders, submitted a proposal, but Greider said it didn't meet the code requirements for a nuisance abatement plan. Kevin Chabotti, director of the city's building services, said the Housing Board voted in November to suspend Davison's registrations on the 4 properties for 6 months. Davison has appealed the decision. Chabotti said he could not recall another time in his 9 years there that another nuisance property owner has had the rental registration suspended or revoked. Police believe that some former tenants or associates of 2307 Beaver Avenue Southeast were affiliated with a gang. They believe the drive-by shootings and shots-fired incidents were in retaliation for an ongoing dispute. Several neighbors interviewed by the Gazette said they feared for their safety because of potential retaliation and spoke with a reporter on the condition of their names not be used. The accounts they provided, however, are supported by police or by videos they shared. One of the neighbors, a 39-year-old hotel manager, said she and others were terrorized in their own homes. She had security cameras installed last year, which she felt was worth the expense. It didn't seem to stop the activity, but did help her back up her complaints to police. The hotel manager said people associated with that house would run back and forth through her yard, making her feel so unsafe that she didn't spend time in her backyard or even use her garage for fear of getting hit by a stray bullet. Another neighbor, a 63-year-old grandmother, said she was considering moving away after living there for 33 years. "It's been a living hell," the grandmother and retired teacher said. "I babysit my 11-month-old grandson and worry for his safety. We've had shootings, stolen cars just left in front of our houses. My husband was in the back barbecuing in October when one drive-by happened. It hit another man's house and gas line." She said the neighborhood has changed from a quiet, peaceful place. She never worried about her three kids walking down to Beaver Park or riding their bicycles with their friends all over the area. The grandmother and other neighbors wrote a group letter that was considered when the safe CR request was sent to the Housing Board of Appeals in November. White, the property holder's employee who had lived at the house, said he thought most of the calls complaining about the property came from one neighbor who had a problem with black individuals living in the home. He said her calls were unfounded. However, the neighbor White referred to wasn't interviewed for this article, and police said none of the neighbors brought up race as being an issue. Police said White himself also had called police for help for noisy parties and people in the yard at 2307 Beaver Avenue Southeast. A teacher who lived near the home said he talked to Lieutenant McGarvey after the December drive-by shooting. A bullet hit his house in the bedroom area, but nobody was injured. The teacher said he had lived there for 17 years, but moved out last August because of the ongoing incidents. He and his family lived in the basement for the last 6 months they were there because they were afraid of further incidents. The teacher said there had been a previous drive-by shooting at the house and a pipe bomb thrown out a car window. He captured those incidents on a surveillance camera and shared them with police. The videos also were shared with the Gazette. Another neighbor, Scott McWhorter, said he first experienced a problem in mid-October 2020, less than 3 months after moving there. His house was struck in a drive-by shooting. There were five or six shots fired, and one bullet left a hole about the size of a 50-cent piece in his steel siding, and another bullet hit his gas line. Police retrieved the bullet from his siding. "I hit the floor when I heard the shots and waited for the shooting to stop," McWhorter said. "When I called 911, the neighbors had already called." McWhorter said there was another drive-by in February in the alley behind 2307 Beaver Avenue Southeast, although the house was vacant by then. Another neighbor provided a video from her surveillance camera of that incident to the Gazette. McWhorter commended police efforts in the neighborhood, saying they likely spent a lot of money for extra patrols. City Councilmember Dale Todd, chairman of the city's Public Safety Committee, said Davison isn't the only property owner to affect a neighborhood, especially a low-income neighborhood. He estimated another nine or so are out there in Cedar Rapids. "These landlords usually stay one step ahead of the problems," Todd said. "We shouldn't normalize these landlord practices. The property owners have a responsibility to make sure their property and the tenants aren't a detriment to the neighborhood." Todd said that in this case, an interdepartmental team of city staff, nuisance abatement, building services, and police, and neighbors were brought together to find solutions. "We started having meetings over video because of the pandemic, and it allowed us to connect the dots in real time and allowed us to hear the emotional pull this activity had on the neighbors," Todd said. He credited German for authorizing this, which hasn't been done before, police sharing information of ongoing investigation with the neighbors. McGarvey said officials expect the house will be likely up for renting out again after the 6-month suspension expires, unless the property owner has more issues with his properties. Police, he said, will be watching the situation. Also, from the Gazette, third day without long-term care outbreak. While one COVID-19-related death was reported Saturday for a long-term care facility, Iowa for the third consecutive day saw no new outbreaks at any of its 429 centers, according to Iowa Department of Public Health data. The decline was notable in that long-term care residents have accounted for more than 39%, 2,225 individuals, of all the 5,674 Iowans who have died from the virus over the past 12 months. The past year, it's almost been like they've been at war with COVID-19, Lori Ristow, Iowa Healthcare Association's Senior Vice President of Strategic Communications, told the Gazette earlier this month. Hospitalization counts in Iowa continue to fluctuate slightly, but they proceeded along their overall downward trend statewide. Since their peak in mid-November at 1,527, with 172 patients reported for Saturday morning, according to the Public Health Department and as analyzed by the Gazette. The state reported 38 patients in intensive care, down 6 as of Friday morning. 20 people were on ventilators, which is one fewer than the day before. In all, two COVID-19 related deaths statewide were recorded, both for people above the age of 80 for the 24-hour period. The CDC has counted 538,261 deaths across the United States since the virus was first reported a year ago. The state public health department reported 466,816 Iowans were fully vaccinated as of early Saturday afternoon. That's about 14.8% of the population. Not quite 1.3 million total doses have been given, according to Gazette analysis of state data. In Linn County, more than 16% of its total population has received all necessary doses for 36,838 residents, and Johnson County has reached slightly more than 19% of its population for full vaccination with 28,854 individuals. As of April 5th, all adult Iowans will be eligible for vaccination, assuming federal allotments are fulfilled, Governor Kim Reynolds announced Wednesday. Pfizer-BioNTech's vaccine is approved for those 16 and older. Moderna and Johnson & Johnson's vaccines are authorized for those 18 and older. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, as of Saturday morning, reported that nationwide, some 121 million total vaccines had been administered. The Iowa Public Health Department recorded 448 new cases of the virus on Saturday. The state's positivity rate for the previous 2 weeks stood at 3.9%. Children under the age of 18 saw 69 new cases statewide. Two new cases were reported for those in education-connected occupations. Linn County added a dozen new COVID-19 cases as of Saturday morning for a 7-day average of 15 cases. Johnson County was slightly higher with 16 new cases. That county had a 7-day average of 11. The top 10 counties in total cases as of Saturday morning were number 1, Polk, 53,349, 2, Linn, 19,697, 3, Scott, 17,474, 4, Blackhawk, 15,137, 5, Woodbury, 14,242, 6, Johnson, 13,313, 7, Dubuque, 12,553, 8, Dallas, 10,450, 9, Pottawatomie, 10,084, and number 10, Story, 9,837. The CDC listed 29.5 million total cases nationwide as of Saturday morning. From the Iowa Today page, catching up on some news, week in Iowa, recap of news across the state from the last 7 days. Vaccines could open up by April 5th. All adult Iowans will be eligible to receive the COVID-19 vaccine starting April 5th, provided the federal government in the coming weeks follows through on its pledged vaccine allocations to the state, Governor Kim Reynolds announced. The state has been moving through tiers of vaccine eligibility, most recently making it available to any adult with a serious health condition. Officials said they will be prepared for the influx of Iowans hoping to make a vaccine appointment. Vaccine rollout. As of Thursday morning, more than 425,000 Iowans had completed their COVID-19 vaccination, and another 320,000 plus had received the first dose of the vaccines that require two doses, according to state public health data. Variant detected. An additional 38 cases of the COVID-19 variant have been confirmed by the state public health department. Infectious disease experts believe this new version of the virus, often called the UK variant because it was first detected there, spreads more rapidly. Tax cuts. The Iowa Senate unanimously approved a package of state tax reductions, including the removal of economic hurdles required before previously approved tax cuts could be enacted. The proposal also would phase out over 3 years the state's inheritance tax. Constitutional carry. The Republican-led Iowa House passed a so-called constitutional carry measure, which removes the requirement that Iowans obtain a permit in order to possess a handgun. Republicans and Democrats disagreed over the legislation's potential impact on background checks and firearms purchases. Democrats said the bill would essentially eliminate background checks, while Republicans argued the proposal would result in more of them. The proposal expected to also pass the GOP-led Iowa Senate. Big Tech. The Iowa Senate, on a party-line vote, approved legislation that would deny tech companies future state and local tax breaks if they are found by a court to have illegally stifled free speech or certain viewpoints on social media platforms. Free speech. The Iowa House voted nearly unanimously to support legislation requiring public universities to protect First Amendment rights, but split along party lines on another bill addressing training and teaching about divisive concepts such as racism, sexism, and political ideology. Tenant rights. The Iowa Senate voted along party lines to approve legislation that says cities cannot prevent landlords from rejecting potential tenants who use government housing vouchers to pay rent. Opponents said the ban will hurt low-income Iowans, including veterans, elderly, and disabled Iowans, who get government housing assistance. They said, "Here I am, down on the ground, suffering from the derecho, and you're going to kick me in the teeth." John Zakrasek of Cedar Rapids, who lost 80% of the trees he owns in the derecho on a proposed state property tax increase on private forest owners, a measure put on pause after the public hearing. The euphoria of the bill will pass. People will get their economic impact payment. They'll spend it, and then we have the burden of paying for it. And when all of that other stuff comes to light, that's when it becomes extremely unpopular. U.S. Senator Joni Ernst, Republican Iowa, on Republicans' opposition to federal pandemic relief. Odds and ends. Iowa DOT funds. The Iowa Transportation Commission has approved using nearly $122 million in federal COVID-19 relief funds to make up for lost fuel tax revenue over the past year and to pay for trail development across the state. Preschool funding. Republican senators are working with Governor Kim Reynolds to direct federal money to cover a projected $7 million shortfall that hit Iowa preschools when enrollments dropped as parents kept their kids home during the COVID-19 pandemic. Affordable housing. An Iowa Senate subcommittee gave bipartisan support to Governor Kim Reynolds' proposal to expand affordable housing options. However, Republican senators raised concerns about the overall budget impact of several big-ticket asks. And water cooler. Immigration. As U.S. officials race to address the rising number of children crossing the U.S.-Mexico border, U.S. Representative Marionette Miller Meeks, R. Iowa, blamed President Joe Biden's administration for rolling back immigration policies that turned unaccompanied minors away at the border and for halting border wall construction. Grassley's intentions. U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley, R. Iowa, said he will not be swayed by recent polling that shows a majority of Iowans, including a third of Iowa Republicans, hope he decides not to seek another term in 2022. Draft Franken. A Marion couple started a social media campaign encouraging Democrat Mike Franken to run for U.S. Senate. Franken ran in the Democratic primary in Iowa's 2020 U.S. Senate race. Turning to the Insight page, no Todd Dorman today. We have the Gazette's editorial, a guest column, and Adam Sullivan's At Liberty column. First, the Gazette's editorial. What is free speech? Iowa politicians could use a lesson on civics. Free speech has been in the news in Iowa a lot this year. It's a cherished American liberty enshrined in the Bill of Rights, but politicians are sometimes imprecise with their use of the term. The GOP-controlled Iowa legislature this year is considering several bills that are presented as protecting free speech but would actually do the opposite. Here are a few examples. Senate File 402 would withhold tax incentives from tech companies that run afoul of the state's concept of censorship, a response to perceived bias against conservatives online in their pursuit of free speech. Legislators would infringe on private companies' rights. Senate Study Bill 1205 would regulate diversity training in public education. The legislation calls for institutions to ensure free expression while also providing a list of prohibited topics and themes, such as saying Iowa is fundamentally racist or sexist. Senate File 41 would eliminate tenure at Iowa's public universities. The bill's backers say it's a response to liberal bias among college faculty. Another bill, Senate File 292, would require regent institutions to issue a report on their employees' political affiliations. Meanwhile, Iowa recently was host to a nationally significant free press trial. Des Moines Register journalist Andrea Sahuri this month was acquitted by a jury of simple misdemeanors stemming from her work covering a protest last summer. The Democratic Polk County attorney's decision to move forward with the trial underscores that misunderstanding the First Amendment is a bipartisan issue. The First Amendment prevents the government from restricting speech through law, with a few exceptions established by the Supreme Court. The First Amendment does not guarantee anyone a platform for their speech, nor does it bar private actors from dissociating with speakers they find objectionable. That is the bastardized vision of free speech Iowa Republicans are promoting with their legislative agenda. The guest column today is by the McCormick Foundation. Test your knowledge of the First Amendment. This is a multiple choice quiz with the answers on the second page, so I will read the questions and then the answers immediately thereafter. The McCormick Foundation originally published this quiz, the Robert R. McCormick Foundation Civils Program. Test your knowledge of the First Amendment. The First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution guarantees Americans certain rights. Do you know which ones? Question 1. How many freedoms are named in the First Amendment? A. 1. B. 5. C. 3. D. 10. The answer is B. 5. Question 2. What freedoms are not in the First Amendment? A. The right to bear arms. B. The right to free enterprise. C. The right to a speedy and public trial. D. All of the above. Or E. None of the above. The answer is D. All of the above. Question 3. When did the Supreme Court first decide that the Internet is protected by the First Amendment? A. 2004. B. 1997. C. We'll review this term. D. Never. The answer is 3. D. Never. Question 4. Which of these has no First Amendment protection? A, pornography, B, poetry, C, obscenity, or D, comic books? The answer is C, obscenity. Question 5. A protest march is made possible by which First Amendment freedom? A, right of assembly, B, freedom of the press, C, freedom of religion, or D, freedom of speech? And the answer is A, right of assembly. The First Amendment protects us against A, the federal government, B, all U.S. governmental bodies, C, public criticism, or D, crude jokes. And the answer is B, all U.S. governmental bodies. 7. The father of the First Amendment is A, George Washington, B, Thomas Jefferson, C, Alexander Hamilton, D, James Madison, or E, Oliver Wendell Holmes. And the answer is D, James Madison. 8. When was the First Amendment adopted? A, 1776, B, 1789, C, 1791, or D, 1865? And the answer to that is C, 1791. Number 9. Can students successfully challenge a public school's dress codes or requirements that students wear uniforms by claiming it violates their First Amendment right to free expression? A, yes, B, it depends, or C, no? And the answer to that one is B, it depends. Number 10, which of these does not have First Amendment protection? A, professional sports, B, ballet, C, hip-hop music, or D, movies? The answer to that one is A, professional sports. Question 11, in the 1969 case involving free speech by public school students, Tinker v. Des Moines Independent Community School District, what symbol worn by the students was at the heart of the dispute? A, an American flag, B, iron crosses, C, black piece armbands, or D, rosary beads? The answer is C, black piece armbands. True or false, school-sponsored prayer is prohibited in public schools. That means students can't pray at school at all in any way. A, true, B, false. The answer is B, it is false. 13, which of these is not protected by the First Amendment? A, a text message criticizing a public official, B, a protest march against illegal immigration, C, a threat against someone, D, a cartoon that makes fun of a religion? And the answer to that one is C, a threat against someone. Question 14. Your First Amendment freedom of assembly means you can protest A, within limits concerning when, where, and how, but not on the message of your protest, B, whenever, wherever, and however you want without restriction, C, only on your own property, or D, on someone else's private property as long as an issue of major public interest is involved. The answer to that one is A, with limits concerning when, where, and how, but not on the message of your protest. Question 15. True or false, it's against the law to burn an American flag to protest government policies. A, true, B, false. That is false. Number 16. The U.S. Constitution provides that the United States is A, a Christian nation, B, Protestant nation, C, nation of churchgoers, D, none of the above. The answer is D, none of the above. 17. Public school officials can censor student newspapers and websites A, always, B, sometimes, or C, never. The answer is B, sometimes. Which of these activities are protected by the Free Press Clause? A, Twitter, B, comments on Facebook, C, blogging about the news, or D, all of the above? The answer is D. 19. Which First Amendment right makes lobbying Congress possible? A, right to assemble, B, freedom of religion, C, right to petition, D, freedom of the press. The answer is C, right to petition. And question 20, what famous American said free speech rocks after a defamation lawsuit against her was dismissed? A, Lady Gaga, B, Nancy Pelosi, C, Oprah Winfrey, or D, Courtney Love? The answer is C, Oprah Winfrey. Adam Sullivan's column for today is At Liberty column. Let Iowa City's young black leaders lead. Iowa City Council members this past week suspended the historic anti-racism panel they put themselves in place just a few months ago. The Ad Hoc Truth and Reconciliation Commission, the first of its kind in Iowa, was conceived last year and held its first meeting in January. The city asked appointees to lead fact-finding, truth-telling, and reconciliation on racial justice issues, a project stemming from the renewed Black Lives Matter protest movement that year. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission has been kind of messy so far, with 3 of 9 members resigning this month. What did anyone expect? Truth commissions are hopeful but messy processes. It cannot be any different since they are created to deal with the toxic legacy of generations of abuse and trauma, Eduardo Gonzalez, a truth and reconciliation expert at George Mason University, wrote in a letter to the council. This hard work was always going to be contentious and uncomfortable. The possibility of commission members publicly and sharply disagreeing was totally foreseeable. The council should have been prepared for it. The mayor suggested suspending the commission after a tense leadership transition and the string of resignations. The council voted 5-2 this past week to suspend the body until next month after vacancies are filled. Johnson County Supervisor Roy Sandparter was initially elected as chairwoman of the commission, but resigned from the role and eventually from the commission altogether after fellow members called for new leadership. Porter is a celebrated community advocate, but as an elected county supervisor, she's also responsible for helping to oversee and establish funding for the sheriff's office, which presents many potential conflicts of interest. And she's a close ally to some city leaders, having supported city campaigns and received support from elected city officials in the past. To be effective, fact finders and truth tellers must have a somewhat adversarial relationship with the powers that be. It's hard to see how that can happen when the powers that be are chairing the meetings. Truth commissions are often instituted during or after governmental transitions, meant to document the abuses of a former regime. But the Iowa City Commission is asked in part to investigate the very government it is part of, from which it draws its authority and funding. The institutions and people who perpetrated any injustice they might uncover are still in place. At best, it's an awkward situation. The City Council committed to creating the commission in June as part of a wider racial justice resolution written in response to mass protests against police killings of George Floyd and other Black Americans. Just a couple of weeks before, Iowa City police were part of a crowd control project that included using flashbangs and chemical munitions against Black Lives Matter protesters. The tear gas haze over Dubuque Street has cleared, but it still looms over local politics. It underscores the recency of the issues set to be addressed by the commission. This isn't about some long-ago historical injustice. It's about us, right here and now. In some ways, Iowa City's reconciliation kerfuffle is symptomatic of a generational divide. Here and elsewhere, there is tension between longtime advocates and young activists, each with their own priorities and theories of political change. But in other ways, it's less about old versus young and more about process versus people or institutionalists versus activists. Proponents of suspending the commission complain that commissioners weren't following the proper procedures. More guidelines worked out by the city or some orientation sessions are the remedy, they say. That sort of strife is to be expected and nothing to shy away from. Desmond Tutu, former chairman of the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission, once said the meetings of the commission right from the beginning were hell. City officials' decision to suspend the commission, albeit temporarily, was ill-conceived. Even though council members insisted otherwise, it can easily be seen as a vote of no confidence in the body's new leadership. One local activist called the commission's suspension a rage quit, a term used when online gamers exit a match in order to avoid inevitable defeat. It's an apt comparison. Remaining commission members vehemently objected to the suspension. They and dozens of their allies spoke at a council meeting last week, calling on the council to keep the panel in action. Even though they were unsuccessful in that, the dispute seemed to re-energize and refocus them. Iowa City has a great asset in its young justice leaders. Now you have to let them lead. The community letters today and also a comic panel from Signe Wilkinson, a syndicated cartoonist distributed by Post Writers Group. The editorial cartoon, such as it is, shows a line of five women, some white, some with darker colored skin, and some Asian, standing in front of a massage parlor, and on each of the women's shirts is written one word. The sentence reads, "Stop violence against all women." The first letter is from Barb Standerson of Iowa City. Vaccine shows better path for healthcare. Though not perfect, the rollout of COVID-19 vaccines is impressive. The federal government helped spur rapid creation of viable vaccines, distributed them to the states and local governments, acted swiftly to get them into the arms of people, especially underserved communities. It's done at no cost to the individual, minimal red tape involved. As a physical therapist working in healthcare, this is a refreshing change to what typically happens in our fractured healthcare system. As many of us have probably experienced, I have witnessed countless delays and outright denials of care that would make people's lives better by for-profit insurance companies. Once we get through the public health crisis caused by this pandemic, we'll still have a public health crisis on our hands. That's because our healthcare system, currently focused on corporate profit instead of care, wasn't working for everyday people before COVID-19 swept the country. The vaccine rollout and distribution show that government can and does work for people when we come together and demand bold action to address the crises we face. That's why, as the Medicare for All Act of 2021 is introduced, it is my hope everyday Americans demand our elected officials take it seriously. Barb Standerson of Iowa City. Next, Sharon Poplosky of Cedar Rapids writes, Hinson not living up to campaign promises. In two recent votes, U.S. Representative Ashley Hinson failed to uphold campaign promises and failed to represent Iowans in her district. In a 2020 interview, when Hinson was asked why the LGBTQ community should support her candidacy, she responded, "I support the LGBTQ community and support everyone's rights as humans. No person should be discriminated against, no person should be bullied because of who they are, and no person should be discriminated against in the workplace for any reason." However, when given the opportunity to fight against discrimination, she voted no to the Equality Act, stating it undermines the First Amendment and threatens religious liberty. Hinson failed to protect the rights of LGBTQ Iowans. Hinson voted no twice on the American Rescue Plan, a significant piece of legislation that provides funding for vaccines and $1,400 stimulus checks to millions of Americans, and extends employment benefits, housing assistance, and small business provisions. Hinson objected to a minimum wage increase in the bill, but still voted no once the increase was removed. Hinson voted no when the bill returned from the Senate, claiming only 10% was for immediate COVID-19 relief. As our first congressional district representative, Hinson failed to acknowledge that the remaining funds reach way beyond immediate needs and are directly COVID-related. Funding for returning to school is one example. Hinson's no vote against the American Rescue Plan is short-sighted and demonstrates a complete lack of knowledge, concern, and compassion for the needs of Iowans in the first congressional district. Sharon Poplosky, Cedar Rapids. The next letter is from John Klaus of Mount Vernon, offering the bird as our new state bird. A recent letter to the Gazette suggested the state bird of Iowa be changed from the goldfinch to the extinct dodo. Does Iowa need a new state bird? March 10th. I would instead suggest a non-extinct bird, even if a metaphorical one. I refer to the proverbial unidigital salute, which seems to be in common use in this fair state, and particularly by outraged citizens, a class that seems more and more prevalent. John Klaus of Mount Vernon. Next, Gary Huxford of Marengo writes, COVID-19 relief bill will help many Americans. Republican lawmakers in Washington, D.C. are not representing their constituents back home. The COVID-19 economic aid package is praised by 70% of the American public, but not a single Republican legislator voted for it. The Republican lawmakers' playbook continues to dwell on the cost of the bill. They would have us believe that the cost outweighs the benefits. The truth is that this bill has a direct effect on the majority of Americans. There is money for public schools, child care, child tax credits, food for hungry children, rental assistance, restaurants and other small businesses, COVID relief, and direct payments to working people. The COVID-19 economic aid package was designed to help people, and that is what it will do. It is extremely popular, and it is the right thing to do. Thank you, President Biden and Democratic legislators. Gary Huxford of Marengo. And the final letter is from Robert Hill of Iowa City, a voice calling leaders to overcome divisions. As a citizen of the United States, I would like to address both Democratic and Republican politicians. I am disgusted with the constant bickering, arguing, lying, and profanity between the members of both the U.S. House of Representatives and the U.S. Senate. The American public is confronted daily with hate, vitriol, lies, and political maneuvering. It seems as if the politicians have lost their souls and moral compasses. What they said yesterday does not mean they believe it today. I love a good debate, but what I have witnessed during the last several years has not been a debate, it has been hate. As a nation and as a people, we need desperately to turn the corner and walk back the hate. I have a suggestion for the legislators. What would happen if the majority party in either House or Senate would approach and ask the minority party, what one piece of legislation would you like to pass? Then work together to debate, find solutions, and pass legislation together to enhance Americans' lives. Once completed, repeat with the other party, and perhaps we could end the all of one party for and all of the other party against reality of today's politics. Has it ever been country before party? I do not mean to paint all politicians as having lost their way, as I know several who have not. I am one voice. Robert Hill of Iowa City. You're listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, March 21st, 2021. I'm your reader, Sharon Faldudo. We turn to the obituaries, and first we have In Memory of Jim Lacey, 1943 to 2021. You may be gone from our sight, but you are never gone from our hearts. P.S. Keep a cold one on ice until I get there. Richard Dwayne Bevins, age 53, of Cedar Rapids, passed away February 16th at Mercy Medical Center in Cedar Rapids. Per Richard's request, he was cremated. There will be no service. A celebration of life will be held from 1 to 8 p.m. May 29th at Jones Park Pavilion on 29th Avenue. He loved his kids and he loved his music, favorite being Soundgarden, almost as much as his ego, meaning Rich always flexing his biceps and calf muscles and telling you to check them out. The people that knew Rich best knew his tough exterior, but they also knew he had a soft spot deep down. Timothy J. Perez, 52, of Cedar Rapids, passed away Saturday afternoon, March 13th, at Unity Point Health Iowa Methodist Medical Center in Des Moines. Visitation will be held from 1 to 2 p.m. Monday at Papik Cuba Funeral Home East, 1228 2nd Street Southeast, Cedar Rapids. Private family graveside services will be held at St. John's Cemetery with Chaplain Bill Warhover, Hospice of Mercy, officiating. Those attending the visitation are respectfully requested to wear masks and practice social distancing. Tim was born January 1, 1969 in Cedar Rapids and was a lifelong resident. In July 2020, Tim received a kidney transplant, which gave him a completely new and different outlook on life. He was a quiet, introspective person with an incredibly generous heart. Tim enjoyed socializing with his friends at the tavern. He was a treasure to his parents and their caregivers in later years. Vicki Ray Perez, 66, of Cedar Rapids, passed away Sunday evening, March 14th at Mercy Medical Center. Visitation will be held from 1 to 2 p.m. Monday at Papich Cubia Funeral Home East, 1228 2nd Street Southeast in Cedar Rapids. Private family graveside services will be held at St. John's Cemetery with Chaplain Bill Warhover, Hospice of Mercy, officiating. Those attending the visitation are respectfully requested to wear masks and practice social distancing. Vicki was employed at Cargill, Incorporated for 44 years. She enjoyed going to casinos and spending time with the girls. Vicki was a dog lover, an excellent cook, and liked to have fun. She was always available to be a caregiver for any family member in need and was a wonderful daughter, sister, and aunt. Our beloved brother, father, grandpa, and friend, Michael Stephen Sexton, was spiritually uplifted through Heaven's Door on February 12th. He received the last rites with Bobby, brother, and Rachel, daughter, by his side in Los Angeles, California. He was loved by so many and kept in contact with family and friends all over the world. We loved him dearly and miss him greatly. Words just escape the loneliness in my heart. Michael worked for Menards, and many customers only wanted to have Michael help them design what they had in mind. Landscaping was another thing of beauty he could do. He loved plants, flowers, and trees. He could change a patch of weeds into the most beautiful setting ever. He had a great eye for design. Then at Hy-Vee, his culinary chef came alive. He could and would try all sorts of new spices and dishes. Michael loved to travel. He especially loved going to Vietnam. The family is hoping to have a celebration of Michael's life sometime this summer and fall in Iowa when we are all COVID safe. Keith O. Lawrence of Decorah died February 7th from COVID-19 while in hospice care in Decorah. He was 95. Despite the quarantine, his daughters were at his side as he peacefully slipped away. A kind and loving husband and father, Keith enjoyed collecting stamps, watching college basketball, attending concerts and plays, acting in community theater, traveling, reading, and solving jigsaw puzzles. As an ISU-certified master gardener, he inspired all his children to continue his love of horticulture. Well-organized and prone to excessive planning, he maintained a quiet patience in a home filled with four overactive children and a harried wife. Interment was at St. Paul's United Methodist Church Columbarium. A memorial service will be held at a later time when it is safe to gather. Vincent J. Zietz, a.k.a. Vince, Vinny, Vinegar, Grandpa, and G-Paw, 70, of Waterloo, died Saturday, March 13th at Lakeland Regional Medical Center in Lakeland, Florida. Everyone knew Vince as a handyman, always there to help with anything they needed, from Iowa to Florida and everywhere in between. Vince went above and beyond for his friends and family. Vince embodied what it means to be a servant leader. Although Vince enjoyed retirement, he couldn't sit still for long. To learn a little more while honing his already extensive skill set, Vince joined BNP Construction to gain more knowledge, which he used to help others, especially his children. Mass of Christian burial will be 11 a.m. Friday, March 26th at Sacred Heart Catholic Church, with burial following in Mount Olivet Cemetery. The funeral also will be live-streamed by the Sacred Heart Church Facebook page. Public visitation will be 2 to 7 p.m. Thursday, March 25th, at Haggerty Wacoff Garrett Funeral Service on West Ridgeway, continuing for 1 hour before services at the church. A time to share will take place from 7 to 8 p.m. at the funeral home after the public visitation. Joylyn McCain, born Joylyn Harkin, 51, of Phoenix, Arizona, formerly of Mount Vernon, passed away surrounded by her family on February 27th. Joylyn graduated from Mount Vernon High School and obtained a BA in education from UNI. She met her husband in Iowa City and shortly after moved to Phoenix, where they raised their three daughters. A celebration of life will be held at a later date. Gary Lee Gurn, 76, of Quincy, Washington, formerly of Marengo, passed due to complications of COVID-19. He rode his tractor to heaven on March 12, 2021. There will be a public graveside service at 10 a.m. Friday, March 26th at Genoa Bluff Cemetery, rural Ladora, with Diane Voorhees officiating. Kloster Funeral Home of Marengo is assisting with arrangements. And Sharon McBroom, born Sharon Airy, age 57, of Chatsworth, Georgia, and formerly of Oxford, died on Saturday, March 13th at her home. A funeral service will be held at 11 a.m. on Saturday, March 27th at the Smith Funeral Home in Grinnell. Visitation with the family present will be held prior to the services, beginning at 9 a.m. at the funeral home. Interment will be at Ivy Hill Cemetery in Malcolm. A face covering will be required for those attending the visitation and funeral service. Sharon's enjoyments were reading and gardening. She will be remembered for her love of horses and her passion to help others. Turning to the sports page of the today's Gazette's NCAA Division I Wrestling Championships, champs again. Lee's courageous title caps Hawkeye's 24th national championship by KJ Pilcher of the Gazette in St. Louis, Missouri. Iowa has returned to the top of college wrestling. The Hawkeyes' accomplishment will deliver some satisfaction to supporters that have craved this moment for a long time. It's been 11 years since a real important trophy has been in Iowa City, and this team, those 35 guys back in that wrestling room, these 10 guys, this coaching staff and administration brought a trophy back that's important to our fan base, Iowa coach Tom Brand said. Spencer Lee put the finishing touches on his top-ranked Hawkeyes' ascension back to the top of college wrestling. He became Iowa's 7th three-time national champion, and Iowa hoisted its first team title since 2010, the 24th in program history, at the NCAA Division I Wrestling Championships last night at Enterprise Center. Iowa State also got in on the title bandwagon thanks to the winning effort of David Carr, who became the 50th Cyclone to earn gold. Lee has been the heart and soul of Iowa reemergence as national leader. His heart showed last night, beating Arizona State's third-seeded Brandon Courtney 7-0 for the 125 title on an ACL tear that occurred about 10 days ago. Lee said he didn't wrestle leading up to the tournament, but had three-hour workouts to be ready. Doctors were shocked at what he willed himself to do and that he could compete. Lee didn't like to discuss it. "Tough it out," said Lee, who still plans to compete at the upcoming Olympic team trials. "It doesn't matter. No excuses." Lee had stated a team title was coming. The team accomplishment was as big of a goal as his own title. "We do our job as individuals, and the team titles come," Lee said. "I do this for the guys who missed out. They missed out on being national champs. I'm sad about it, but I'm thankful for the NCAA allowing this to happen. So thanks very much for letting us get back what was ours." Lee joins Ed Binnock, 1980, 81, and 1983, Barry Davis, 82, 83, and 1985, Jim Zaleski, 1982 to 84, current head coach Tom Brands, 1990-92, Lincoln McElravy, 1993-94 and 1997, and Joe Williams, 1996-98. "I won three. Awesome. Good for me," Lee said. "We won the team title. Awesome. That's what we came here to do. This is what I wanted. This is what I've been training my whole life and now worry about what's next." 40 years ago, Carr's father, Nate, won his first of three national championships for Iowa State. Now the younger Carr has one of his own. Likely more to come. "I told him when I decided to come to Iowa State, I wanted to come here, bring back the program, and break all of his goals while I'm at it," Carr said. "That's a big goal." Carr blanked Riders Jesse Delavecchia 4-0 in the 157 final, becoming the first Cyclone titleist since Kyvan Gadson won the 197-pound title here in 2015. He capped an impressive tournament with two major decisions and three hard-fought matches. Time expired, and Carr began the celebration, which included a backflip that was met by a tackle from assistant coach Brent Metcalf. The display was almost a reenactment of the end of Metcalf's loss to Darian Caldwell in the 2009 finals in this arena. "It was fun," Carr said with a big grin. "Just have that moment with my coach. He's pushed me a lot this year, and he's one of the reasons why I'm winning at this big stage and winning." Lee was one of three Hawkeyes in the finals, but only one to capture gold. Iowa's Jaden Ironman, 141, and 174-pounder Michael Kemmerer, both top seeds, were forced to settle for silver. Both fell to Penn State foes in rematches of the Big Ten finals. Ironman recorded his fourth All-American performance, reaching the finals for the first time after getting third, fourth, and fifth at Missouri. Ironman faced number two Nick Lee, who managed a third-period takedown and converted an inside trip in sudden victory one for a 4-2 decision. Kemmerer and third-seeded Carter Starachi had a similar result. Both exchanged escapes in regulation with Kemmerer fending off close calls in the first and third periods. Starachi was able to drop in on a double leg and finished covering Kemmerer's hips for a takedown and 3-1 win in sudden victory 1. The Hawkeyes tallied 129 points, beating runner-up Penn State by 15.5. Oklahoma State was third with 99.5. This marks the fourth national title in Brand's 15-year tenure, adding to three straight from 2008 to 2010. And Iowa men's basketball NCAA tournament, Hawkeyes control the havoc, move to round two. Iowa dumps Grand Canyon, Oregon, up next by Mike Loss of the Gazette in Indianapolis. Iowa did Saturday what number two seeds are supposed to do in the first round of an NCAA men's basketball tournament. There was no allowing the plucky underdog from a mid-major conference to hang around all game and then pluck you from the tournament, as number 15 seed Oral Roberts did to number two seed Ohio State on Saturday, or as 13 seed North Texas did to four seed Purdue. "Watching games yesterday," Iowa's Luca Garza said, "you've got to learn some lessons from the other teams. We wanted to make sure we threw the first punch tonight." Garza punched away early with a pair of three-pointers in the first 2 minutes and 27 seconds, and the Hawkeyes jumped to an 11-2 lead against the 15-seed
Grand Canyon at Indiana Farmers Coliseum. They never trailed in their 86-74 win over the Western Athletic Conference champs from Phoenix. Iowa, 22-8, advanced to a Monday second-round matchup against Pac-10 regular season champion Oregon, with the time in Indianapolis location determined late last night. And the women's team will also be playing today. The women's tournament starts with the Hawkeyes and the Chippewas. Iowa has to be ready to tip off at 11 a.m. today. Caitlin Clark won't be hitting the snooze button this morning. "When I'm up," she said. "Honestly, I probably won't sleep much." We're the first game of the tournament. We're on ESPN. How can you not be excited about that? Clark and three other Iowa starters will make their NCAA women's basketball tournament debut today when the fifth-seeded Hawkeyes, 18-9, face 12-seed Central Michigan, 18-8. Tip-off is at 11 a.m. at the Alamo Dome in San Antonio, Texas. And as Clark correctly stated, the game will be televised nationally on ESPN. "Obviously, we're extremely thrilled to be here," Iowa coach Lisa Bluter said. "I'm glad we have an early game. We arrive late Wednesday, and usually when you fly in, you play the next day. Everybody just wants to play, and I'm glad that we get to do it right away. We want to be here a long time." Turning to the Iowa Today, Iowa profile, Cedar Rapids man takes on special role in derecho recovery. "I work for the Tree Canopy of Iowa," coordinator says, by Marissa Payne of the Gazette. Nick McGrath, 32, was a middle school choir teacher when his career took a surprise detour after he had worked a seasonal job at a Marion Gardening Center. There, the Cedar Rapids resident absolutely fell in love with the work and quickly went from the guy watering trees to the guy ordering them. Fast forward several years, and now he is helping Iowa's communities pick trees to plant after the August 10th derecho devastated a tree canopy that had taken generations to grow. McGrath, in January, started in a joint position with the Iowa Department of Natural Resources and local nonprofit Trees Forever, funded by the U.S. Forest Service and the state as a community disaster recovery coordinator based in Marion. He works with derecho-affected communities to help them access resources they need to recover from damage stemming from trees lost in the storm. The foundation of his passion for nature was laid as a child through involvement with the Eagle Scouts, and his whole family loved to travel and go tent camping, he said. "It was kind of a great combination of all of the odd jobs I may have held in the past, garden center, educator, athletic coach, with having all those ties to community as well as the plant knowledge needed to carry out this position," McGrath said of his interest in his new role. He's working on outreach to the 293 communities that the Iowa DNR has identified as affected by the derecho. "Whether it's a city's mayor or Parks and Recreation Department official, he tries to identify someone who can help him learn the extent of the damage. Then he can provide baseline information to coordinate potential grant opportunities, help communities pick out and order trees, and answer questions as they contemplate what to do." McGrath has a tall task ahead of him. The U.S. Department of Agriculture estimated Iowa's tree canopy at 2.9 million acres before the storm, and the Iowa DNR reported more than 724,000 acres, about 25% of the state's urban forest, were downed in the derecho. "I feel like I work for the tree canopy of Iowa," McGrath said. Jill Johnson, the Midwest Urban Forestry Coordinator with the Forest Service, said McGrath's job is a fairly unusual one in the region and potentially in the country. The only other such position in the region was created to help Joplin, Missouri, recover from an EF5 multiple vortex tornado that struck in 2011. Johnson toured the Iowa storm aftermath last summer and said it was the most significant tree damage she had seen in a geographic area in about 18 years she's held in her Midwest role. Johnson said the coordinator role in Joplin made recovery efforts there more efficient. In Joplin, she said it was helpful to have this coordinator there to fill knowledge gaps and to provide technical expertise, coordinate volunteer efforts and donations, help with replanting logistics, and listen to community needs and communicate those to other organizations. The Iowa DNR team agreed, and with a proven history of successful collaboration with Trees Forever, the position came to life. "Those who worked in Joplin found the role to be such a strong model for community recovery," she said, "that it was extended beyond its initial two-year timeline. You have to recover from this tree loss and help people keep as much canopy as they can that's still safe. It has to be safe for them, has to be structurally sound and balanced," Johnson said. "But you also need to replant those trees that have been gone. But then also, the recovery process for humans often involves replanting. It's that feeling that people get from regreening and replanting, even if they're not going to be around to see the tree back at the same size as it was, that there's a real healing there." Emma Hannigan, an urban forestry coordinator with the Iowa DNR, said it was apparent soon after the derecho that data from an aerial assessment as well as direct follow-up to communities through a coordinator role would be key to Iowa's recovery. "Larger cities typically have a forester on staff and crews to support work focused on trees, but smaller communities often rely on volunteer efforts to recover. Some cities, like Cedar Rapids, are preparing to replant this spring, but other communities may be in a different stage of recovery and feel hesitant to replant again given the damage fallen trees may have caused. The Iowa DNR wants to help people understand the benefits of trees and their true impact on a community. We're really wanting to set it up so that we can continue to help communities past 2 years, because trees are such a long-term component, and for what we've lost, it's going to take a long time to recover, Hannigan said. Trees Forever founding president Shannon Ramsey said this position represents a partnership to bring more help to the area. Over time, she said, McGrath can also use mapping data once it's available to focus more on where to replant trees. He already has helped order trees for distribution events, Ramsey said, and she sees coordination with nurseries being a key part of his role in the future so they can supply trees that match what the community wants. Nick McGrath has the knowledge and expertise we needed to help procure quality native trees early, help target needs, and assist small towns and neighborhoods, Ramsey said. McGrath said he wants to empower people to strategically plant trees and equip residents with knowledge to keep those trees alive and healthy for generations. It's for communities 50 years down the road, 100 years down the road, McGrath said. I'm not going to reap the benefit of a new linden outside my house, but maybe my daughter will someday.
That's pretty neat. The Time Machine profile today, Phyllis Fleming, She Did It All in 45 Years in the Gazette's Newsroom, by Diane Fannin Langton, correspondent. Phyllis Fleming spent 45 years working in the Gazette newsroom, most of it in leadership positions, before retiring in 2002. It's been 10 years since she died, and she seems a good person to write about during Women's History Month. Fleming was born in Stewart in West Central Iowa in 1935. She was an honor student at the high school in Garner, where her father taught vocational agriculture, graduating in 1952. She enrolled at the University of Iowa to major in journalism and spent the summer after her freshman year working for the Garner Leader and Signal newspaper. In her sophomore year, she joined the photo staff of the UI student yearbook, The Hawkeye. She was news editor of the student newspaper, The Daily Iowan, a plum competitive post before graduating with honors in 1956. Her first job was at the Billings, Montana Gazette for $65 a week. It didn't take long for Fleming to recognize she wanted something different. Fleming was offered a job at the Champaign-Urbana News Gazette, but also interviewed for a Gazette job that offered a mix of editing and news reporting. That combination persuaded her, and she chose the Gazette starting in September 1957. She was on the job for a week when her boss left on vacation and Fleming was on her own. She not only had to edit stories, but also design pages, something she'd never done before. She was a quick study. In addition to editing duties, she wrote more than 700 byline stories before 1969, when she became the newspaper's Sunday editor. Among her first stories was one on cadet teachers, student teachers, and one about the new University of Iowa Medical Research Center, for which she took 5 photos. 3 years later, Fleming spent 2 months traveling in Europe with the University of Iowa Scottish Highlanders, an all-female bagpipe and drum marching unit. She sent back pictures and stories from the tour and counted the experience as one of the highlights of her career. Fleming thought she would move on from Cedar Rapids after a few years, but she was still at the paper 12 years later when she became Sunday editor. She had less time for writing in her new job, though she managed stories on the Chicago Board of Trade, a mystery convention in Omaha, and her trips to Budapest, Vienna, and Prague, a testament to her love of travel. One of her more memorable stories was a student power symposium at the University of Iowa Memorial Union in February 1969, at the height of Vietnam War protests, when someone set off a tear gas canister as a crowd of about 800 was waiting for the program to begin. One of the night's speakers was anti-war activist Tom Hayden. People evacuated to an upstairs ballroom where the session continued without further interruption. Fleming had filled other newsroom positions, including city editor and assistant managing editor, when she won the Iowa Newspaper Association's Distinguished Service Award in 1992. One of her last major projects was coordinating the 25-part Homefront World War II in Iowa series in 2001, commemorating the 60th anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor. Fleming retired in 2002 after 45 years with the Gazette. She continued to help with special projects, including one of technology in 2003 and a Cedar Rapids history book in 2004. She wrote a history of the Gazette in 2005. She also served on advisory boards at the University of Iowa School of Journalism and of the Daily Iowan for more than 20 years. The nature of news is that it's constantly new, but that doesn't change, is the nature of reporting. It is based on truth and facts, Fleming would say in her commanding voice, the reader comes first. Ever conscious of even the appearance of a conflict of interest, Fleming didn't join community organizations while she worked in the newsroom. She made one exception for Friends of the Cedar Rapids Public Library. After she retired, she became a docent for the Cedar Rapids Museum of Art and a library trustee. A big fan of performances at UI's Hancher Auditorium, she helped bring the famed Joffrey Ballet to Iowa City. In January 2011, when Fleming was dying of duodenal cancer, she was inducted into the UI School of Journalism and Mass Communications Hall of Fame. Most of the newsroom attended the presentation at the care facility where she was staying. A few weeks later, Fleming died on February 18, 2011,
at age 75. And we'll wrap up with some things to do this week, powered by the Hoopla section, a lecture connecting Bruce Moore's families and Grant Wood. Bruce Moore Museum Program Manager Jessica Peel Austin will share the history of the plaster mural created by Grant Wood on one of Bruce Moore's sleeping porches. That is 2 to 3 p.m. today, which is Sunday, March 21st, online at the Cedar Rapids Museum of Art. That is free. Music, Family Folk Machine online mini concert, One Planet. Family Folk Machine is a nonprofit, intergenerational, non-audition choir that welcomes kids and adults of all ages to perform. That's 3 p.m. today, online with Family Folk Machine. The cost is free. Family Bunny Bash. The farm will be springing with fun attractions, and Bloomsbury Bunny will be hopping around for photos. 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Saturday, March 28th, April 2nd and 4th. At Bloomsbury Farm, 3260 69th Street in Atkins. That is $12.95. Theater, The People Before the Park. Writer Keith Joseph Atkins transports the audience into the lives of hardworking father and his daydreaming son living in New York City's Seneca Village in 1856. The story unfolds as this proud African-American community comes together when the city threatens to remove the entire neighborhood from their homes to make way for Central Park. That is 8 p.m. Friday to April 4th, online at the University of Iowa Theater Building, and that is free. And music, the Eli Young Band. The Eli Young Band emerges from the pandemic to play its hit singles and fan favorites and maybe some of the 70 new songs written during the past year. Opening for the group will be Tyler Richton and the High Bank Boys from Central Iowa. That's 8 p.m. Wednesday at the Alliant Energy Powerhouse, 370 First Avenue Northeast in Cedar Rapids. The cost is $28 to $68. And gardening, Winter Gardening Fair for the Love of Monarchs. Linn County Master Gardener Carol Elliott will teach you how you can make a difference for monarchs and raise your own generation of monarchs or swallowtails. That's 11 a.m. to noon on Saturday, online at the Indian Creek Nature Center, and it's $5. And that brings us to the end of the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, March 21st, 2021. I've been your reader, Sharon Falduto. Remember that you can listen to a recording of this or any other IRIS recordings anytime at our website, iowaradioreading.org. Thank you for listening.